This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, we're talking about the Indonesian novelist Pramoda Anandatur. And to help us in this discussion is Sumit Mandal. He is a historian at University Kebangsaan, Malaysia. And also with us is Jason Tan. He is the editor of The B-Side. Now, Sumit, thanks so much for being here. Most of us think of Pram as a novelist, and this is a show about philosophy and social theory. And what would be the connection? How would we kind of justify having Pram, as important as he is, on a show like this?
Well, first of all, we would acknowledge that Pramudia was a novelist, a short story writer, an essayist, and a writer of histories. So in this show, we are going to be looking at how he had particular ideas and conceptualizations about history that would infuse really the range of his work, from the short stories to the novels and the actual history writing.
All right, so it's the concept of history, or a particular way of looking at the whole question of history, that's important.
And that would be the bigger framework, but it's too big to be doing on Night School today, so we will narrow it down to just a question of the nation. How did he view the nation, and how did he do historical research to support his conceptualization of the nation?
Perhaps our regular listeners and myself and you, we're all kind of familiar with Pram. We call him Pram, I think, for short, out of affection. But there are many people who perhaps have not been introduced to his work. I think some years ago, his novel was on the syllabus, but I'm not quite sure how many Malaysians actually are familiar with him. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about him.
Yeah, of course. I think one whole generation of Malaysians, largely people who read in Malay, would have come to know Pram through Keluarga Gerilya, so the Gerilla family. And that's a book set in the pre-60s era. Today we're talking mostly about the 60s, that dealt with the Indonesian Revolution. And that book was part of the sixth form syllabus in Malay literature, well into the 70s, I think. And then I haven't quite figured out when it dropped off the syllabus, but I don't think it's being taught now. Now, another group of Malaysian readers, at least, would have come to know Pram through his English translations. And there, I think the books that have been notable are what's called the Buru Tetralogy. So the four books in English are This Earth of Mankind, Child of All Nations, Footsteps, and The Glass House. So it's a four-volume work that's been translated into numerous languages, and people have read them in English in Malaysia. And it traces through a fictional account of a historical figure the early rise of Indonesian nationalism. There's one more important source is the work done by Jomo K.S. and Hasnul Saidon, who started a book publishing outfit called Wira Karya. And that was in the 80s. And they published the Indonesian versions of the same quartet and actually circulated them in Malaysia when they were banned in Indonesia under Suharto. So there's a really interesting relationship between Malaysians and Indonesians that way. And those books were read by yet another group of readers in Malaysia who could grapple with the Indonesian with a glossary to explain the difficult Javanese and Dutch words.
Right. Sumit, you mentioned book banning. Now, that's a word that resonates with us. So why were his works banned?
And also, on that point, he himself suffered quite a bit of political persecution and was in jail for many years.
He was in behind bars without trial for a total of 18 years in his entire life in all three regimes that rule Indonesia up to Suharto. And to focus just on the Suharto period, when the tetralogy, the Buru tetralogy, was banned, as well as other books, it was the idea that the Suharto government, what we call the New Order, had that Pramudia's work was infused with a latent Marxism.
Weren't many of the books written while he was in prison?
The Buru tetralogy was, because it's named after the island where he was put in exile, Pulau Buru, Buruh Island in Maluku in eastern Indonesia.
Now, just before we get into the substance, you have a personal relationship to Pram as well.
Yes, I first met him when I was doing my doctoral research on a topic in Indonesian history, looking at the emergence of Arabness in Java under colonial rule. And I spoke to him because I'd read a Malaysian published version of Bumi Manusia, This Earth of Mankind, in 1986. I'm going over to Indonesia to do my field research, and I was interested to meet him. And so that was the first time, and we talked a lot about history, and he really had a very imaginative approach to the kind of dry sources that sometimes I had to work with. And I think that's inspired me to carry on this rather long-term research that I continue to do on this aspect of his life. The second time was during Reformasi in the late 90s when I spent several days. I stayed with him and interviewed him, and I've had those interviews transcribed now, and I'm working with some of the material from those interviews even as we speak. And the third time was shortly before he passed away in 2005. So I've met him over a period of maybe 20 years.
You did interviews with him and you recorded his voice, and you actually have brought along a recording. Could you just give us a context for this recording?
Sure. At that time, I was interested in a number of issues in speaking to Pramandia. And here I spoke to him about art and the writer. What is the role of the writer in society? He's talking about fungsi buku, the function of books.
Ya fungsi buku selamanya ya pendemokrasian kehidupan. Semua fungsi buku. Sebab dia bisa dibaca semua orang, bisa dikritik semua orang. Dan buku itu sendiri dalam keadaan tidak berubah. Semua orang boleh mengkritik. Semua orang boleh mengecam. Itu demokratis. Itu fungsi buku. Kalau fungsi sastranya sendiri, sorry, saya bukan juru bicara sastra. Itu pekerjaan sangat individual.
Sangat individual, ya?
Individual.
Kalau begitu, sebagai individu, Bung Pram rasanya apa dalam menulis sastra?
Ya, saya mengendaki plafon budaya naik, bukan sebaliknya turun.
Macam mana itu? Naik itu apa?
Ya, memahami kemanusiaan lebih baik. Memahami keadilan, kebenaran lebih baik. Itu sebabnya untuk saya, menulis itu bukan hanya tugas pribadi, juga tugas nasional. Saya bukan membuat tulisan hiburan. Ya, kalau saya jadi juru bicara diri saya sendiri, ya bisa saja. Tapi bukan juru bicara sastra.
In the clip, he avoids the big question that I ask him, and that's very typical of him. I'm no spokesman for Indonesian literature or literature. I believe that books are about the democratization of life, because books appear in a particular form. They don't change. They circulate, and anyone can criticize a book, and that in itself is democratic. What else? Well, it's also a very individual kind of work. And why does he write? Because he wants, the Indonesian term is plafon budaya, it's the cultural ceiling to rise and not, in fact, deteriorate. And why do this? What is his whole life investment in this? To understand humanity better, to understand justice, to understand truth. And writing is not only a personal task, a personal job, but also a national task.
So there he mentions the word the national task. Now, the question is, what is his concept of the national, and where does it emerge in his work most distinctively? And, you know, is there a particular text that we could go to begin a discussion of Pram's contribution to the discourse of nationhood?
Yeah, I think we could go to a number, but today we'll look at a book that he wrote in Indonesian in 1960 called Huakiao di Indonesia. It's been translated, and it's translated as The Chinese in Indonesia, and was published in 2007 in English.
Was Pram himself Chinese?
Pram himself, no. He was born in Blora, Java, in 1925.
What does that make him? It makes him Javanese?
It'd make him Javanese, yeah. And perhaps I should give some background to why the book was written. Around 1959, 1960, largely pushed by the military, the Indonesian government enforced a law that required the Chinese Indonesians who had long established themselves in rural areas, in small trade, middlemen trade, to leave those businesses. And a time frame was given to abandon those businesses by the early 1960s. And in some parts of Indonesia, especially in West Java, there were pogroms.
By pogroms, you mean mass killings?
There were routings of Chinese from villages, some killings, not mass killings. But Chinese people were harmed for their racial, ethnic background. And Pramudia saw this happening and saw the growing racialized discourse and felt that he needed to respond to that.
What's the background to this? What was the official line justifying these pogroms?
That it was part of a program of nationalizing the economy. And the Chinese were seen, following from colonial stereotyping in the past, but well into the independent era, as economic exploiters, perhaps. But Pramudia's own view was, he had a much more complex view of Chineseness. And what he did was to write in a newspaper called Bintang Minggu, a series of 10 letters directed at a, from the name you could tell from the initials, to a Chinese person living in China. And so he wrote these letters, frequently appearing on the front page of the newspaper, in which he declared his affection and his desire to explain in a way this situation, because it troubled his moral conscience. But in the process, what he does in each of these letters is produce an entirely different history within which he contextualizes Chineseness. Chinese, for him, are not just economic animals as they had been bandied about during the period. They are people who have contributed enormously to the cultural history of Indonesia, to the economic history, to the various kinds of agricultural innovations. All these things he does in the course of these letters, which eventually in 1960 get published in the form of a book. And the book, then all 10,000 copies that come out of the press are seized by the military and destroyed. Because from the military's point of view, Pramudia had shown far too much fraternity towards the Chinese, who were regarded as a sworn enemy because of their communist ideological underpinnings.
A quick note about the Party Communist Indonesia, the fact that it was in fact a legal organization, and Pram's own leftist leanings. Mm-hmm. Is that important to understand the man and his concepts?
It becomes important to understand because after 65, when Suharto takes over from Sukarno during a rather bloody political process of transition, Pramudia is labeled as a communist, and he's often seen by Malaysian intellectuals and similarly labeled here as part of a communist intellectual elite in Indonesia whose views one should avoid. But really in this period, I would stress his internationalism. He comes out of the Bandung meetings, the growing non-aligned movement, which in early 60s becomes solidified as the non-aligned movement. He had just returned from China. He saw the world in very internationalist terms.
Now, we're going to come back with more on the novelist Pramudia Anantatur, and in particular, his notions of the nation. You've been listening to Sumit Mandal. He's a historian with University Kebangsaan Malaysia. Jason Tan, editor of The B-Side. Myself, Sharad Kutin, on Night School, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and Night School continues. We're speaking about the Indonesian novelist Pramudia Anantatur and his notions of the nation, together with Sumit Mandal, he's a historian with University Kebangsaan Malaysia, and Jason Tan, editor of The B-Side. Sumit, we left off with a characterization of Pram as an internationalist in a time of tremendous turmoil. World was decolonizing. We had the Cold War kind of really peaking in the 60s. And here's a man writing to, is it a fictional character, a real person in China, trying to kind of make sense of what you say was something that troubled him, the move against the Chinese community that had established itself as middlemen and in all kinds of roles in rural Indonesia. Now, where do we go with this book? You say it was banned or copies were seized once it was published as a book. What's in the book itself?
I meant to also correct something or to clarify something I said earlier. When I mentioned his, he showed affection or fraternity for the Chinese, I meant the Chinese in China, the state of China. About the book, it also led to his imprisonment under the independent government of Indonesia for a period of about a year. To give you a sense, I want to read you an opening from the book, how he addresses this person who actually, as I found out later on, is a real person, a person who acted as his interpreter in Beijing. And he says the following: "On this night, which is enveloped by the atmosphere of Christmas and the coming of the new year, my heart feels truly moved to be able to speak with my own soul, a soul that for some time recently has been upset by the agitation about the Hua Kiao problem. There's not a force on this earth that one can that can stop a person from speaking with his own soul." And then he says, "Possibly other people will ask, why does this problem attract and disturb my soul so much? That I shall not deny. First of all, because my feeling of humanism is offended. Second, because I prefer being friends with the peoples of all countries. And third, because I too could not deny if it was said that it's possible I have Chinese blood flowing through me. And Xia Ru, the person he addresses, there is nothing more precious in this life than friendship because it gives our life so much greater breadth. It is only enmity that narrows life." So it's in this kind of very intimate language that he then pitches a deeply historical argument. But what I've tried to argue in things I've written about in regarding this book is that it produces a language of intimacy and so on that's as equally visceral, maybe, that stirs emotions in the same way that racist vitriol does, you know. So he angered many people by, at a time when there was so much anti-Chinese racism, with this feelings of love and affection that he's showing towards a Chinese person.
Was he exceptional in this regard?
I think so. And from interviews with people who were around, intellectuals of the time, they felt he was exceptional. He believes he was exceptional. In fact, he doesn't say that to claim credit, but he was a deep sense of disappointment, I think, that there weren't other people who wrote. It, as you can see, it was very risky to take this position internally and because it involved geostrategic politics. And he became a victim of that.
Well, I think there is a certain humanism that underpins his concepts here. And, you know, when he talked about, in that interview with you, he talked about fungsi buku itu adalah demokrasi dan demokrasi itu adalah yang berperi kemanusiaan. So I think it's important here to make the equivalence between democracy and something that is empathetic, something that is very human. And that democracy is not just an abstract concept or a Western concept, and it cuts across ideology, if I think anyway.
One of the things that one reads when reading about Pram is that he was an autodidact. I mean, the idea that he's a self-taught man. He's not in his period he would be kind of intellectual. I mean, he was educated. He wasn't uneducated. But so what is this? What do we make of this claim that he was an autodidact and such?
When I think about what are the sources of his own thinking, his ideas, where did he derive some of his thinking from? He says, well, he read a lot of Maxim Gorky and he admired John Steinbeck. So there were these kinds of influences, but I don't see necessarily a direct parallel between that and the idea of nation, which we'll discuss. I place a lot of importance on that idea of the autodidact. He wasn't alone that way. Many people had their educations interrupted by the Second World War and the Japanese occupation. There's a whole generation of people who were intellectually vibrant and so on who dropped out of school. And then came the revolution, and then came the beginnings of the Indonesian state, and actually economic and political decline for a long period. And so they never actually continued a formal education as much as they wanted to. And there are many qualities that then they have as a result of being an autodidact. But one important thing I'd like to stress is it really left him with the tools to experiment with fragments of information, or with ideas, with texts that he saw in a way that's very different from an historian who's trained and has gone through formal procedures and is taught to differentiate between things, you know, to value and prioritize between sources. He says in some of his works and in interviews about how he would wander into his father's library because he wasn't allowed to into the library when the father was around. He would sneak in, and it was a library of a man who was deeply invested in the early Indonesian struggle. And there were all kinds of sources there, Dutch encyclopedias, interesting novels and so forth. And he, even though he didn't know all the languages, he struggled with these things, played with them, and he would ask some of his elder siblings who had been to school and learned some of the language. And he would, in this process, discover all little gems of information which he was really capable of exploiting and deepening and then putting into his work, you know. And I think being an autodidact gives you this freedom if you choose to do so. But if I may only mention only one trait that I also found as a result, was he had an enormous curiosity about what it meant to then be a proper academic, a so-called proper academic. He often envied that, you know. And when, meanwhile, as an academic talking to him, you envied the imagination and the creativity and the enormously powerful ways in which he had spoken to Indonesian people.
Now, do we want to go through the book? I mean, how does he plot his arguments? You say the it opens with this letter to his friend in Beijing. And how does he begin to do this history?
The entire book is made up of letters to Chen Xiaoru. And they are letters that actually go into many different questions. I'm going to focus on the sixth letter, which looks at the contributions of the Chinese, and more specifically to questions of culture. And he talks, for instance, about how if we are to hate the Chinese so much, what would we do with our history? Because we couldn't write a history of Indonesia without Chinese sources. And so this is what he writes in translation. Chinese have written about Indonesia since the first century of the Christian era. And Jetiao, which we can guess is Jawa Dwipa, the ancient name for Java, was reported by a Chinese traveler in 132 AD. There were also reports of visits by Indonesian ambassadors to China. Even from these brief reports, we can discover that our people already had advanced skills in shipbuilding and knowledge of the stars and the winds. But even more important, it shows that our people already had a government and a foreign policy. I mean, there are little snippets like this, but he is, I left out actually the scholarly citation. He cites scholars and weaves these snippets into a history of Indonesia within which the Chinese are very much part of the fabric.
But here we're talking about something outside the fabric, right? I mean, you're talking about a foreign nation, its scholars, an empire that is writing about perhaps satellites or states that are paying homage to it. Then the question is, how does that question of the Chinese in the fabric of Indonesia become much more intimate?
I use an example that might be regarded to be outside of at least that contemporary national fabric, around the time, let's say, of the 20th century when Pramudia is speaking. But he speaks of another example, and that is Melayu Tionghoa, the language of that one could translate as Chinese Malay, which, let me read something of what he says. There are those in Indonesian society, mainly teachers of the Indonesian language, who belittle Chinese Malay without taking into account the social and sociological process related to the function of this mishmash of a language. They hold firmly to book language, you know, originally recognized and lauded by Raffles and then officially legitimized by the Dutch Indies and so forth. Now, he says that rather than a language to be looked down, the influence of Chinese Malay was quite profound. And he names the figure Lee Kim Hock, The influence of Chinese Malay, I quote again, of Lee Kim Hock, spread throughout the Chinese Malay press in Indonesia and became the standard for this mishmash language, strange yet easy and flexible. And after the collapse of Dutch colonialism in 1942, the Dutch language shut up shop and Indonesian formally replaced it. Since then, the influence of Chinese Malay has entered in official Indonesian as well. Now, if you look at some works on linguistic theories and so on, the history of languages, you find that Pramudia has pointed out something that many scholars speak about, which is how things that are called vernaculars and so on eventually have a profound influence on the very languages that we think are so pure and so official and that we protect by placing borders. And he saw in Chinese Malay a very dynamic and fresh language that if you think about continues to influence Indonesian till today.
What is Chinese Malay or Melayu Tionghoa?
Well, it sounds odd more in English than in Malay. If you think about it, Melayu Tionghoa, it's a language. It's the language that evolved in marketplaces in the early 20th century. Initially, it had to do with economic affairs, but it became the language of public life. And people started to write in it. And some sense of that language is the way in which, till today in Jakarta, there is an unofficial but widely used language of Guelu. One doesn't say saya dan kamu or saya dan anda, but people speak using a Hokkien vocabulary that's no longer recognized as Hokkien, but it's entirely Indonesian. It's just Gue for saya, for I, and Lu for anda or kamu. That's a very, very inconsequential example. But I've also seen that influence through films and so on crossing over to Malaysia.
So here you get much more intimacy. Now you're talking about the very terms in which people describe their world is now, kind of...
And the very terms of the language that then is claimed to be the national language.
So was this an argument that was novel in his time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's an argument that's then informed some very innovative scholarship. A colleague of mine named Hank Meyer has done enormous work and credits Pramudia for this.
In response to his assertion of this inextricable links between Chineseness and Indonesian identity, what did his detractors have to say? What could they mount as an argument against it?
This book is a very polemical book too, which is why it's often escaped attention. It's not seen as a piece of good literature or even good journalism. They mount racist arguments. He has as a title of one of his letters, basically letter number 2, about digging up crimes that are not there. Part of the logic of racialized politics is you create a boogeyman, right? So a whole list of economic and other crimes are listed. For instance, even with Melayu Tionghoa, one could say that the very thing that he believes is dynamic, others might regard on the basis of seeing language as something pure and unadulterated as the bad influence of the Chinese. So it's always sort of taking these undercurrents and turning them around to be very productive.
What next in his kind of construction of this argument? Where does he go, especially with regard to the initial question that you had brought up, the question of the nation?
He differed considerably from other Indonesian intellectuals for having not just stood out and taken risks by writing this, but this idea, if you think about it, how many people who claim to be nationalists, Pramudia would not claim otherwise, he felt he was a nationalist, would have in the thick of nationalism, I would say well into the 60s in Indonesia, one would say it was a period of high nationalism, develop an idea that was inclusionary, but inclusionary not as in a multicultural framework or a multiracial framework or say a safe, for instance, in Malaysia, at least from the regime or elites, you see an inter-ethnic alliance. His is a deeply radical hybrid and culturally mixed notion of nation. It doesn't mean that he feels that ethnic groups don't exist and so on, but he focuses on the things that make a nation, like a language, like a literature. He has notions of civilization and culture. They may seem outdated, but he has notions of such measures. And of even civilized behavior that way. But he seldom dwells on abstractions. That's why I think of him as an historian. He's very inspiring that way because he works with material. He works with text. He does archival research whenever he could, whenever he was free to do so. And so he weaves into this very idea of a nation a very mixed fabric, right, that inevitably means that it cannot be an exclusionary framework. If I may, I can read you a quote from a book which builds on this nicely. And this would be recognizable to English readers because it's been widely translated. It's the second book of the Buru Tetralogy, and it's called The Child of All Nations. And here he's describing the protagonist, Minka, in the second volume of his awakening as a young nationalist leader in the early 20th century. I walked straight away in the direction of that bamboo house. Not only Europe, this modern age had delivered breasts to suckle me from the people of this land themselves, from Japan, China, America, India, Arabia, from all the peoples on the surface of this earth. They are the mother wolves who nurtured me to become the builder of Rome. Are you truly going to build Rome? Yes, I answered to myself. How, I don't know, I humbly admitted. I am the infant of all peoples from all ages, past and present. Indeed, the place and time of birth, the parents, were merely a coincidence, not at all something sacred. So hopefully this paragraph gives some sense of why the book is called Child of All Nations, or Anak Semua Bangsa in Indonesian.
So before we come to the end of kind of discussion of Pram, what else do you think is important to take note of?
Well, to think that the idea of nation that he's promoting in these books are profoundly grounded histories that offer different ideas about, say, in the 60s, when he's writing the book, The Chinese in Indonesia, an increasingly racialized space. That's when these histories are stories of another reality, of openings, of possibilities that become very, very important. So it's not a sort of idle, say, commercially driven notion of advertising, you know, that tries to draw and build on diversity and multiculturalism in perhaps intellectually idle ways. I think it's a very deeply concerned desire to examine the nation. Now, I say this to underscore that he introduced the term in Indonesian. He used the term nasion, and it was really sounded odd in its time, but I found it actually in a dictionary of the time, but one that was produced by a scholar, so it wasn't really a popular dictionary. It was around, but it was a really unusual term to use because people use bangsa and suku bangsa, which are the usual terms in Malay and Malay spoken in Indonesia and in Malaysia for race and ethnic group. He thought that these terms were filled with confusion because, as we know, for instance, in the Malaysian case, when we deal with the state, bangsa, as is used in official forms, really means race. But otherwise, bangsa has historically meant many things. One could speak of bangsa pedagang, a group of traders, you know, or trading people. So bangsa as a Malay word wasn't linked entirely to race. But in any case, to avoid these sorts of confusions, and I think to infuse his project with a conceptual clarity, he really wanted to have the word nasion used and thought through much more carefully in the Indonesian instance, because it would force people to think about the beyond nationalistic slogans, how is it that one constitutes this community? And I think that question is something that requires examination in this country too, in Malaysia.
I think basically in his writings, he lays the seeds. In his writings about nationalism and nation, I think he lays the seeds, as far as from my uninformed point of view, he lays the seeds of the obliteration of the idea of the nation in the first place.
That's a very good point, because what happens is many nation states, and it's Malaysia or Indonesia, by no means exceptional. The U.S. European nation states inevitably claim to end at the borders, and they not just border controls but controls on culture and so forth. So what happens with a conceptualization of the nation that is in an extremely disciplined way open to outside influences, constantly drawing, is yes, the possibility of also being ready for a globalized world, for a trans-regional connected world. Mm. So Pramudya's nation is a connected nation.
Great.
We can carry on this conversation, but before that, a recommendation from Sumit before you leave. What book would you suggest we start off with?
Well, since it's available in English and not particularly well known, something that many people might enjoy reading or find valuable reading in dealing with the Malaysian context is The Chinese in Indonesia by Pramudya Anantatur, quite well translated and published out of Singapore by Select Books in 2007. If you read Indonesian, you can try to get the Indonesian version from Gerak Budaya.
Well, thank you so much, Sumit, for joining us. You can carry on this conversation with Sumit on our Facebook page, which is Night School. Also, you can write to us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com, and we'll forward your questions to Sumit. Thank you so much, Jason Tan. Jason Tan, of course, is with the B-side. Yeah. Sumit is with University Kebangsaan Malaysia and is a historian there. And I'm Sharad Kutin. This has been Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.